Welcome to Formula Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And Cindy, it was cold. It's been cold.
Mm-hmm.
You know what that means.
It's so fun. It's so wonderful. I love it. Yeah, I know what it means.
I know what it means to you. It's always snowing in your brain. You wait for this time of the year.
I love it. I love it. I live for it. Can't wait.
Food-wise, mm-hmm. wine-wise, it begs a change.
Well,
right?
See, I also love this time of year for cooking, too, so I like it all. Yeah. Yeah, you want braised dishes and wonderful, long, slow-cooked food, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, low and slow, long and careful,
mm-hmm.
thoughtful, things you put a lot of care and thought into.
Well, and the nice thing about these cuts of meat and birds and things that we use this time of the year are less expensive because they're off, you know, they're not primal cuts.
Well, they can be.
You're not braising. Go ahead.
If you pick the things that are not super fashionable,
mm-hmm.
like all of a sudden duck legs are very fashionable. So confit, which is a classic, duck leg confit is a classic thing for comfort in the wintertime. That you would make, right?
But well, yeah, they used to be like $3.69 a pound. They're not anymore.
Oh.
Yeah, it's a huge change. Well, it's still less expensive than your, you know, beef tenderloin at God knows how much money. So, you know, that's the difference. While it all follows each other, while the off-prime cuts are less expensive, they are more expensive than they ever have been. True.
For some things, like, say, veal, for example, scallopini are nice to have, and they can make beautiful dishes. But to me, or veal tenderloin is fabulous, mm-hmm. but these are pretty delicately flavored meats,
mm-hmm.
if you're a meat eater. And if you want more rich flavors, especially this time of the year, braise a veal shoulder.
Oh my gosh, yes.
Braise veal necks.
Well, yeah, and veal shoulder has all sorts of wonderful, you know, it has a good amount of fat in it. You know, it's got connective tissue and all kinds of things that add gelatin to the dish. So, you know, if you can get, you know, parts with bones in as well helps too. That creates flavor.
Yeah, I mean it's the initial sear when you go to braise. One, let's talk about process of braising, just the steps, like out of the gate for different kinds of items. Because braising chicken is very different from braising
An
entire veal shoulder,
right?
Or lamb shanks or venison shanks.
Mm-hmm.
That's a great thing, venison shanks.
Oh gosh, yum.
Venison ossobuco.
Well, and there's a lot of hunting going on last couple of weeks, too, so the season was open for deer.
Yeah, it's very different braising something like a chicken, you know, or an entire veal shoulder or lamb shanks or venison shanks. Oh, my gosh, I love venison ossobuco.
Yeah, and deer season just opened up, too, so it was open for a couple of weeks. I don't know if it's over, but, yeah, so there's probably a lot of folks that have some wild game they can braise. I think the biggest thing is, okay, what is it coming out of? For us, a lot of our big pieces of meat come out of cryovac, which means you really have to let it air out for a minute, and then you have to blot it with a paper towel and, you know, get that excess blood off the outside of it because it's just going to splatter all over you when you go into a hot pan with oil. As we all know, oil and liquid don't mix, so you want to try and get some of that excess off, and then you know, you're either cutting, if it's a big piece of meat, like a veal shoulder, you're probably cutting it into large pieces. And then, you know, as always, whenever you're trying to brown something, you have to have a large surface. You have to have the right size surface to brown on.
So steps of braising, you have to have a large vessel,
mm-hmm.
a larger vessel than you probably think with a heavy bottom to initially. So if it's veal shoulder, it's an enormous roasting pan. If it's chickens, it's something that's big enough for at least two of whatever it is that you're going to braise.
Yeah.
Because a lot of liquid is going to go in there.
Right.
But you also need the big heat conduction in the initial searing, right?
Right.
That's why you need that heavy bottom.
So I want to talk about pans. All right, so what you're saying is absolutely correct. And then also you have a sauteuse and a sautoir. I was describing this to my cooks the other day because he was trying to a slope-sided pan or a straight-sided pan. And the difference between a slope-sided, you know, something going out on an angle versus straight up and down makes a huge difference when you're browning something or trying to brown something. You know, he was cooking, we cook, you know, 10 pounds of button mushrooms at a time, and we need them to become caramelized. And if the same process of trying to brown a piece of meat before you braise it, if you're in a straight-sided pan, just recognize that that contains the steam. And if you're in a slope-sided pan, the steam escapes better, so more rapidly, which allows, obviously, that's moisture. You want it to escape because that helps you to brown your food better and quicker and nicer. So I have actually gotten to the point where sometimes I'll sear something off in a separate pan that has a slope side just so that I can get it nice and brown. And then I put it in the pot that's the braising pot that's got high sides because I'm going to add a bunch of liquid and mirepoix and whatever else I'm going to add. So you can do it all in one step if you want. You don't want to make two pans dirty. Believe me, I get it. I don't like doing my dishes. I love to cook, but I hate to do dishes. But, you know, it's an idea. Anyway, so you my chefs in school always said smoking. Your oil needs to be to the point of smoking. And that's a little scary to tell somebody that's cooking at home. So I'm going to say just before the point of smoking oil, that's when you want to start to add your food.
So that's when you see the oil like moving around on the pan on its own.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And you only put in one layer of meat or fish or what, you know, whatever in the world you're cooking, well, anything that you're braising. So one layer, let it brown, turn it around, get it brown on all sides. And if you have to, take that out, put some more oil in or remove the old oil and add new oil. If your oil is too dark, you might want to get it out of there and add fresh and continue until all of the meat is beautifully browned. And, you know, it can be sitting on a sheet pan next to your stove while you're doing different batches.
And it takes patience and it takes moving it around. And it takes also, if you're using tongs or multiple instruments for a larger piece, like I'm one of the strange people that I want to braise an entire Beale shoulder, not the pieces.
Okay.
So to move that guy around, it takes, you know, like two big sets of tongs or a big fork and a set of tongs just to maneuver that in the pan and to do it carefully, thoughtfully, so you don't splash yourself.
Right. Well, that's the other thing.
It's a big deal.
You are dealing with high heat, fat, and liquid, so please be very careful because it will splatter on you. So then once it's nice and brown, the thing about if you do decide to brown in a separate pan, you need to deglaze that pan with liquid because that pan has developed a lot of flavor. So if you are taking that advice of trying to do some in a separate pan, make sure you deglaze it with light stock or red wine or whatever liquid it is you're adding to your pot. You could even deglaze with water if you wanted to, but obviously it's better to add something with flavor. But anyway, the pot where, let's say you're doing it all in one, you're deglazing that pan with, in the case of veal shoulder, probably white wine, a light chicken and veal stock or even chicken stock or just veal stock, any of the above or combination. And prior to that, you want to add your mirepoix. I'm sorry, before you deglaze, you would add mirepoix. So carrots, celery, onion in this case. I would go light on carrots for veal. I would go heavier on carrots for beef or lamb or venison. It's usually 50% onion, 25% celery, 25% carrot.
With classic mirepoix, I would use for poultry, for pork, for veal. When I get into things with stronger flavors, like lamb, like venison, honestly, beef as well, I'll put fennel in that mix as well.
Fennel. Dried or fresh?
No, fresh.
Oh, nice.
Into the mirepoix. It's another
That's
aromatic.
It's very unusual. Yeah.
It's another aromatic.
Okay. Well, you have to like fennel to do that, but that would be delicious.
It balances with some of the gaminess and the stronger flavors.
Yeah, I get it. So once you've added your mirepoix, work it around in the pan a little bit and then then deglaze with red wine, white wine, stock, whatever you're using, and add your aromatics. So in most cases, at least a few black peppercorns and a little bit of bay leaf, a couple of them. You don't need, 25. And if you do like thyme or if you think that's appropriate or if you want a little sprig of rosemary, just be careful because it's a long cook time. You don't want a lot of... You want it to be kind of neutral as it's going through the cooking process. You can start to add things when it's done.
What you want is to heighten the flavor over time of the product you're cooking.
Exactly, which that stock ends up being the best, especially if you're using something with bones, because all that meat and bone makes for a delicious broth in that pot. It's going to be really good. And so you bring it up to a boil, and then you turn it down to the lowest simmer and just let it go very, like you say, low and slow. And you can choose to put a lid on it. You can choose to put it in your oven. You can do it on the stovetop. Whatever you want to do, it works both ways.
But so that you can visualize it, what you have is a large vessel that at this point has that meat that you browned well on all sides that has all the vegetables, the mirepoix, and the other aromatics that you add to it that are tossed in there that are then, and all of it is immersed in whatever the liquid is you're braising it in, if it's the stock or whatever the appropriate liquid is.
You really want the liquid a couple of inches above the level of all the product.
Yeah, because it's going to reduce.
Yes. Yeah, and you want to keep it at that level while it's...
And it's going to be there for a while. That's why the oven oftentimes is the easiest ways to deal with it.
It just depends on if you are strong enough to, you know, look at it, pull the thing out, you know, pull the rack out.
Maneuvering
really,
it.
Either way, you know, and sometimes we don't have the luxury of keeping it on the stovetop. Maybe we have to go into the oven because you need your stovetop for something else that you're doing. And that's understandable. I mean, I used to live in an apartment with two burners. So, you know, a lot went in the oven. So that's, you know, it just depends on what equipment you have.
So I guess one of the questions is then, of course, what do you do with a dish like this? What do you do alongside of it? What is the end result? How long, let's say, if you're braising chickens or you're braising lamb shanks, veal shanks, you know, or that entire veal shoulder, how long? How do you know it's done?
You want it to be what we say fork tender. So you should be able to literally just pull it apart with a fork and then it's done. It really should be. You wouldn't need a knife, in other words, to eat it.
All but falling off the bone.
Right. And
not quite, but all but.
Right. And also with that liquid, you know, you kind of the next step of the process is once the meat is tender or bird, whatever you're doing, and you pull that out, and then you want to kind of decide what you're doing with your liquid. You know, this wonderful flavor, most likely you're straining it because all the mirepoix is dead at this point, and you want to get the bay leaves and peppercorns out. So you would pull the meat out, try to watch out for the bay leaves and the peppercorns. You want to discard those and then strain the liquid and put it, you can either put it back in that pot if that's appropriate or put it in another one and begin to reduce it. And if you feel like there's not enough flavor, reduce it. If you feel like it would be more appropriate, like say something like a chicken broth, if you did coq au vin, you probably want to add a little roux to it because something like that kind of light broth will not reduce down to sauce texture without, you know, going to the point of you're just like, ooh, this is awful. So with the lighter birds and things, you would want to add a light roux and then let that cook out for 30 minutes, strain it again, you know, and then maybe you want to add mushrooms to it or you want to add something else to that particular cooking process. This is the time to do it. You can certainly add mushrooms from the beginning if you wish, but you could also add them now. And then what are the accompaniments? Are you maybe taking some of that broth out and making rice with it? Are you perhaps just going to make a potato gratin or you're going to make roasted root vegetables? Those are things that can happen completely separately.
Well, I want to dial back to the very beginning. One thing we jumped right past.
Mm-hmm.
So you have these chickens, you have these lamb shanks, you have the veal shanks, you have whatever it might be. You have to season them, and you have to do it thoroughly before they ever go in there. So after, whether it's coming out of cryovac, you know, the wrap and gets blotted or whatever, when that product is dry and ready to go in, you have to season it really well. Mm-hmm. And that usually to do it best is you make almost like with a little bit of oil, neutral cooking oil like canola,
mm-hmm,
or safflower or something, with a good bit of salt and a good bit of black pepper if that's your choice. You can use other things as well if you wish, but that wouldn't go too heavy in any direction. But at least those things, you want to all but massage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And if it's a bird, it's inside and out.
Yeah.
With that seasoning, and that a lot of people neglect that. You can't sprinkle salt on something that's cooked for 4 hours. And have it be seasoned. It doesn't work. It has to happen from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the, you know, old guys I grew up cooking with was always you season three times, mm-hmm, not heavily any time,
mm-hmm,
in the beginning, during cooking, and to finish.
Yeah.
And you know, and it doesn't mean it's crazy, but being patient and thorough and doing that before it ever goes in the pan has a lot to do with the flavor that you develop over
right.
time.
Well, and be conscious of the fact that when you do season it, that it's becoming a part of the sauce, so that your sauce may not need a lot more seasoning,
right,
you know, because it's going to cook so long. So be conscious of that. Be careful seasoning in the middle. Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely.
That's good.
Yeah,
I almost asked you that, and I should have, because there are times when I will braise something and I won't season it first. It's very rare, but I think it really has more to do with the long, you know, if it's a really long cook time. But yeah, I mean, it does make sense to me that you would season it well in the beginning.
I will admit, I tend to have a very personal relationship with whatever it is that I'm going to braise and that seasoning. It's, you know, it's, I mean, cooking is a physical act,
well,
right?
Well, that's very true. Mm-hmm. Yeah, all right.
You want to show care. So anyway, whenever this is finished, one of the things to think about is what are the characteristics of what's coming out of that pan, and what do you want to serve it with, And maybe if it's something, if it's veal, it's not an intensely flavored, but there's richness to it, you know, so you may not want the most intense things with that. That's not the place maybe for the you know, the briny, spicy mustard greens.
No.
but that's certainly the place for really like a lovely carré gratin to go alongside of it.
That would be nice.
You know, or maybe that's a good place for, you know, a cauliflower and potato puree.
Mm-hmm.
Something, you know, that, think about what is that principal thing it's going to bounce off of? How well does that balance? And then what is the accent that goes with that? Well, again, like the veal, you don't want gremolata, but now lamb shanks.
Yeah, you might.
You might. You know, you want the lemon, you want the garlic, you want the herbs, you want the little zip that's there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you want the little sharpness of the vinegar.
That's the whole key to cooking. Everything that goes with the main center plate item needs to simply be in harmony with it.
Yeah, it's
that's what you're looking for.
That's what I look for.
Yep.
Wine with the dish. It's all music and dancing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
We'll get out of the dancing and further into wintertime cooking. More about braising, winter vegetables, and winter wine, of course, on Formula Wolf on Food & Wine on WIPR. Welcome back to Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And Cindy, we're deep into braising before we got into ballroom dancing.
It's some of my favorite cooking to be done.
You know what? Your whole house smells great.
Oh, it's so wonderful. And you can make it for a couple of days. You know, I mean, it's better the next day. It's just something you can make different dishes with it. I mean, that's the beautiful thing of it. Just having that in the refrigerator seems like heaven to me, you know.
If you have a little bit of like leftover lamb shank.
Mm.
And you have like crusty bread.
Oh yeah.
You know, you grill that.
Oh yeah.
A little bit of the cold lamb shank.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a little of like aioli or something like a garlicky mayonnaise, you know.
Yummy.
Fresh red onions, green olives.
Okay.
That's a happy little.
That sounds really good to me. I could eat that right now.
Mm-hmm. Crostone.
Well, and you were talking about the garnishes, and you were talking about the veal, and of course the traditional blanquette de veau has the pearl onions and the button mushrooms.
That's one of the best practice dishes because
you
can also take it.
It really
you can
is.
Take it lighter or darker because you can make it very pale and very delicate,
which is the way it's supposed to be made.
Yeah, or you can make it the Cindy way.
And brown it
because you want more flavor. I want more flavor, more horsepower in my blanquette de
veau. That's right. Yeah. That's right. Have you seen my car? But yes, the traditional way of making blanquette de veau is to not brown the veal, so you go right into...
And use white veal stock.
Right. It's all about that.
It's paleness.
It's paleness, yeah. So the garnish is appropriate and perfect because, and you can use pearl onions or like I'll use cipollinis because I'm in love with cipollini onions, but it is traditional to use a little pearl onions and button mushrooms and that's the garnish and it's a delicious dish and you absolutely have to add a roux to that sauce to make it the right consistency. Just a light.
Once upon a time with Kiko for fun, made a version of that. But leaned it in a different way with lotus root and a little bit of ginger.
Oh, that's neat.
And it was great.
Oh, yummy.
It was great.
Oh, my. Yeah, that sounds good.
It was great.
Well, and sort of the opposite end of the spectrum, you've been talking about lamb shanks. I mean, you know, that is something where you really brown the meat, and it takes a while to brown the meat. And that is a big piece of meat. Oh, my gosh. It's a big piece of meat, but it gives you, well, certainly not as big as your whole veal shoulder. Anyway, but you can cut up a veal shoulder. But with the lamb shank, it's got great, because it's the leg bone. It has beautiful marrow in that bone. It has a beautiful bone. It has cartilage. It has all the good things that you need to make an absolutely delicious sauce. That's one of the reasons why people love braised lamb shanks so much. They don't realize that what they're probably really, really, really loving is an excellent sauce that can come from that.
Yeah.
And the lamb shank can become very tender. And, you know, you can choose to pop that bone out of there and not serve it with the bone, or you can leave it on the bone and serve it. Either way. But that dish, what would you, you know, what are you thinking? Garnish it because you need heavier, stronger flavored.
You want stronger things. I mean, that's the place for your spicy mustard greens.
Mm-hmm.
That's the place for just stronger vegetables in general. I mean, spicy mustard greens, turnips.
Beets.
You know.
Beets would be really good with lamb shank. Oh, you don't like beets with lamb shank? Oh, I do.
Yeah, yeah, like, I can do that.
Good red beets, frankly.
I was going to say red beets or Chayogas.
Not necessarily fancy ones.
Not the Goldens.
Yeah. Turnips, okay. I've got a whole field of turnips for you.
Oh, yeah.
A whole field.
Turnip greens.
They're big, too.
Turnips are perfect because the plant is a little bitter. The greens are very bitter. And if you have some, a little like agrodolce or something with that, you know, something that's got a little bit of sweetness to it to finish, like a toasted pineapple, agrodolce.
I was going to say, what is that? Wait, I'm not sure what that is.
Agrodolce, agro is bitter. Dolce is sweet.
Oh, okay.
So you're literally kind of like directly hitting that sort of thing.
Got it.
You know, if you're doing like, if you have onions or shallots and you cook them down style as a garnish, as like a condiment.
I was going to say, and garlic too. I mean, it would be nice to have pieces of garlic and really just have, you know, all of those things. You know, to me, roasted parsnips would be nice with that as well. I love parsnips and celeriac. We're doing celeriac chips right now sometimes for the bar, just for a little snack. And oh my gosh, they're so good. So if you wanted something crispy to add to this dish that is all soft and tender, it might be fun to have something like that.
But having the bitter, the other thing I was going to say, if you put the bitter garnishes like the turnips with, and then polenta, which is inherently sweet because of the corn, you have a little vegetable agrodolce right there. Mm. You know,
polenta and lamb shank, perfection. Absolutely.
Well, I mean, that's we're talking about this in the morning. I mean,
yeah, I'm so hungry.
Polenta with eggs, you know.
Oh.
Polenta with eggs.
Yes.
Polenta cooked in the duck fat from duck bacon and duck eggs.
Good
and
heavens.
Then little duck bacon sandwiches alongside
of that. That's a good Sunday
that.
Brunch item.
That's yeah, it sure is.
We need that for Sunday brunch.
Yeah.
Well, and also with like
a glass of dolcetto. Yeah.
Oh gosh, and also with the braised, like if we were doing braised short ribs, beef short ribs, my favorite is potato gratin. Or you know, you were mentioning like cauliflower gratin, and potato maybe together, but potato gratin with Gruyere and Reggiano and a little bit of cream and salt and pepper between the layers. That's really my favorite with the flavor of the short rib and the sauce.
Short ribs with Brussels sprouts.
Oh, see,
I like
beef. I'm just not big on Brussels sprouts.
Oh, that's,
I'll eat them.
You know, maybe Brussels isn't
what
into you either.
Yeah, well, maybe not. But yeah, I'm not into Brussels sprouts. But that would be delicious with that. Brussels sprouts would also hold up to, well, they're so strongly flavored, they hold up to anything. Oh. So for the lamb shank would be nice too. Maybe a little bit of bacon or pancetta on there.
Brussels sprouts done almost like a stir fry with garlic and a little sesame and a little soy.
Yeah, that'd be good.
And the short ribs. And your potato business. I would want that.
Yeah. Or potato puree with beef short ribs.
Well, that's with puree, maybe better.
So delicious. Yeah. And well, and then if you're thinking about making coq au vin, you know, that garnish is with lardon. So that's the interesting thing. That's the thing that makes coq au vin to me so delicious is those items that are traditional to that region of France for that dish.
Right. It's the other thing is a little secret about the coq au vin is like, yes, there is flavor from the wine, because literally, coq au vin is a cock cooked in wine, right?
Right.
That's the traditional
bird,
right?
We call it a spent bird.
The sneaky great thing to me in coq au vin is the little bit of smoke that it picks up. I think if you're going to use bacon as a garnish, you don't just throw it in as a garnish. There has to be some in the cooking so that you get that smoke.
Yes.
In the dish,
not a lot, but a little hint of it for sure. Yeah, and coq au vin is just, I mean, it's the definition of braising because it is an older bird that they would traditionally have used in France. It's a bird that's not good for anything anymore, you know? So it really is tough. So that's the definition of why you braise something, to make it edible, quite frankly, and to not waste anything. So that's good. Well, and talk about prices. Pork is the least expensive thing you can buy right now. Sometimes
that remains, and sometimes really good quality pork, Berkshire pork.
Yeah.
That's really beautifully raised and humanely raised and has great flavor.
Mm-hmm.
That eats a great diet, so it provides excellent flavor.
Yeah, I bought pork spare ribs for the first time I think in my entire life the other day, and we ate them and for employee meal, and I forgot how good they are. That meat between those bones is not a lot of it, but man, is it flavorful because of all that the bone and everything and cartilage and the braising process with something like that is so much shorter because it's a small piece of meat and, you know, it's probably an hour and 15 minutes versus 2 or 3 hours. So that's nice. But, you know, and that stock once you eat the meat and you've got a sauce for it or whatever, you maybe reserve some of that and use that stock for a million other things, one of which for me would be making Hoppin' John. I love to make Hoppin' John with that pork spare rib stock. So that's kind of fun.
Have you ever braised a whole fresh ham?
No. I've roasted a whole fresh ham, but I've never braised one.
That can be great. That's I'm just remembering my great grandmother, one of her things that she once in a while would make. She'd take it, she'd split it like down one side, so you could get to the bone, and she'd stuff garlic and season the inside and outside as well, and season and put some mustard seeds in there, and she put some mustard seeds in the like the whole ones in the raisin liquid and peppercorns.
Okay. And, That sounds good. I think sometimes we forget that there is such a thing as a fresh ham.
Yeah.
I think that people think of ham as
only preserved.
Yeah. That cut of the hog is absolutely available fresh, and that's not expensive at all. Yeah. That's a very good thing to work with for a large group of people.
She served that with kale, and she made apple jelly.
So what's the Maryland thing? I can't think of the name of
it. You're talking about the stuffed ham?
Is that sort of similar in a way?
It's.
I know someone.
It's all Southern.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, it's all Southern cooking in the end.
But
yeah, I mean, you're using what's available at that time of the year.
Right.
But yeah, she would, you know, do like spicy kale, that and apple jelly.
Oh, would be apple jelly, really?
And,
oh my goodness, and I love it.
And big surprise biscuits.
Oh, oof, yummy.
Yeah.
Wow, I'm just like.
You want like big, fat, smoky Alsace Pinot Gris for something like that.
Okay.
You know, in a second.
All right.
A little bit sweet, rich, and good acid spine. It's interesting. I think the most interesting cook-a-bone recipe I ever heard was from a winemaker's wife in Gevrey-Chambertin. She always used some of the spent lees, literally the dead yeast cells from the winemaking, in the braise.
Wow. Which yum.
It's like you talk about your farmer's wisdom kind of thing.
Is that right?
No, that's not available necessarily.
No, not unless you're making your own red
212-something zip code, but...
Please. I wonder how much she put in there. Probably just a little.
She said, you know, it's a whip with a hand gesture, you know, like,
Love it.
Thanks for the guidance.
So what wine are we drinking with it?
I don't know why. I will admit, Italian grandmothers, the nonnas, their direction in the kitchen, much more precise than French ladies who are a little careful about their secrets, you know?
Oh, okay. I see what you're saying.
That's all.
Okay. All right.
They were a little bit, a little bit more generous with their information when I'm quizzing them over the years. Wine-wise, it's going to sound funny, but I think I'd like darker, heavier Pinot Noir, more rustic. So Burgundy, I mean, it's not a surprise. Mm-hmm. That's where the dish is from.
Of course.
But maybe not the big-name villages. You know, the villages up north, Marsannay, you know, Fissan, and south of the Côte d'Or, in the area of the Côte Chalonnais, Mercure, Givry can be really good with, like gutsy Pinot, maybe not the most finesse, but really satisfying and can clean up that sauce.
Great.
You know, and something, and not too old.
So then they're less expensive,
it's not
too,
something delicate.
Right? Because they're not in those.
No Burgundy is that inexpensive at this point.
Well,
that's good quality.
Certainly. Okay, got it.
That being said, we're on a really good run of vintages. You got 21 is not good. Otherwise, you know, which is the newest one that's in the market at the moment.
21 is?
But 21 is not the one you want.
Got it.
But 20, 19, 18, all strong, 17. Pretty darn decent.
Oh, that's good because it makes
16,
it easier to remember.
16, very strong. Yeah. 15 is very solid. Stylistically, they're all a little bit different. I mean, if I was going to pick a year to have with it, you know, like a Marsannay from like 17 or something, not too fruity, you know, something like that would be nice, you know.
What about with a lamb shank?
Lamb shank, it's really hard for me. It depends on the garnishes a bit.
Uh-huh.
But it's hard not to... It's hard not to go Italian and to think more rustic.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not Barolo and Barbaresco, which can be pretty refined. Maybe that's more go south to Basilicata, to Arianico del Vettore, wines like that, or Sagrantino from Umbria. You know, that one of the real geniuses in Italian wine is a producer, Paolo Bea, B-E-A, mm-hmm. Is the last name, and is several bottlings of Sagrantino and Sagrantino blends that are just stunning and super interesting, but they can be marvelous. And what else? From the Alto Adige, Lagrein, which is, yes, German name. It's a grape that's in a region of the old Austrian Empire, you know. But that's dense, maybe the weight of like Syrah, something like that. But we'll
do well. So Grein is a grape varietal?
Lagrein, L-A-G-R-E-I-N, is a grape varietal. It's, yeah.
Okay.
Not cool. In some ways, not unlike Aglianico, not unlike some Syrah. It's in that family.
Yeah, it's good about the vintages. I think that's one of my concerns when I go to buy wine, is that I can't always remember what were the best years.
Actually, there's a grape that grows that's it's kind of an ancestor, a relative, but from 3,000 years ago, grows down in Calabria, called Magliocco. Gallioppo is the most prominent, important red grape in that region. But Magliocco, actually, if you see it on the vine and you see the leaf shape and the way it grows, it's so much like Syrah. And it's because it's related genetically to Syrah. And it's obvious that that grape landed there and worked and morphed and changed as it headed north, you know, to get to places like Hermitage. Or into the Dolomites to the Grein.
Very good.
But
good.
That also, if you find something that's Magliocco or really robust Gallioppo Magliocco blend from Calabria, which I don't know how much there is in Baltimore.
Braised beef short rib.
We're gonna have to get to that in the next segment. What I would like is a big glass of something. I'll tell you about in the next segment. On Formula Wolf on Food and Wine on WIPR. Welcome back to Formula Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
All right, you're asking about the braised short rib.
Yes.
Here's one of the few dishes where I would say, you probably can drink whatever you want.
Oh, no way.
But red, yeah. It's a pretty broad range that can work with that.
Cabernet Sauvignon.
The people who are like, I love California Cabernet Sauvignon, then great. Would I drink Bordeaux with that? Yes. Mm-hmm. What I drink, a wine from Spain, a rich Tempranillo from Ribera del Duero, yes, in a heartbeat.
Sure.
What I drink, wine from Priorat in Catalonia, that's yes, in a heartbeat. Mm-hmm. What I drink, big chef at the pop.
Bring on the cellar.
You just need flavor. You just need flavor. Yeah, I mean, that's what I drink, really robust Burgundy, sure, in a heartbeat. Syrah, there are excellent producers that's all over the place. Washington State Tempranillo, sure. I mean, there's a broad, it's a pretty neutral, it needs intensity and it needs some power to it.
Yeah, it's a good vehicle for something strong.
But it's somewhat neutral. It doesn't want a particular edge like a lamb shank, and it doesn't require a different kind of edge than something like Cocoba, you know. That the slightly trickier match is we talk about venison shank for a second. That that's something with good intensity, but there's not much fat there,
right?
And the stock is not as strong in flavor, so the meat has the strength of flavor more than the sauce has the strength of flavor, and that's different from something like a short rib or a lamb shank. You know, so that's a little bit different. That's more particular. How you match that. That's, like Chianti Classico.
You don't want to blow it up.
You don't want to blow it up, but you want intensity and you want a little edge and something to some, like almost something that matches the umami edge or the gaminess of the meat, or what can be a little bit gamey of the meat.
Well, and hopefully you're serving something fatty with the venison too.
You would think so.
Or lean. Mm-hmm.
I've had very like all American versus that kind of thing, where it was like a sweet potato dish served along with you know, whether it's soup de gratin or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, again, something like Gans Glasgow, that can work just fine. You don't want delicate things with it.
No.
That's for sure. You can, it can take a little edge, but nothing too spicy, I wouldn't say.
Well, the other thing you could do is you could actually add potatoes or something like that to the pot while you're cooking, near the end of the cooking process too, that you actually don't strain out and that you eat.
Yeah.
You know, you could even do onion, celery, a little bit of garlic, the carrots and potatoes, and add it at the end, you know, like my mom would have done. Mm-hmm. Honestly, that's what she used to do with her lamb stew. Well, I grew up eating lamb stew with carrots and onions. She would buy pearl onions for that when she could find them, and potatoes in, and those potatoes are, I mean, man, there's nothing better than those potatoes cooked in that lamb broth. So that would be nice for the venison to do as well.
That's, I made grandma latte before for that, but instead of the lemon, crushed pomegranate seeds.
Mm, yum.
Into that. And that has its own little particular bitter edge,
right,
to it, you know.
Right. We work with pomegranate molasses too, and it might be fun to wave a little bit of that over, or even have it on the side as a dish.
You could use that as part of a pomegranate agrodolce.
Yeah, that would be yummy.
For something like that.
I love that
venison
stuff.
Shank also, like with corn pudding or
mm-hmm. spoon bread. And the whole thing with, you know, spoon bread was that it was a sideboard dish, and that's so nice for families to serve it that way in a casserole dish or a great gratin dish, whatever you have. And it's really simply you cook polenta or cornmeal in cream with a little bit of salt and pepper from the beginning, and then you just cook it for a few minutes, and you add eggs to it and lay it out in a casserole dish and bake it in the oven in a water bath. And oh my gosh, at say 325 degrees, depending on how tall your dish is, you know, it can be done in 30, 45 minutes. And that's just delicious. And all you have to do is pop that into the casserole, you know, server, and put it on the sideboard or put it on the table and let everybody help themselves. And I love spoon bread. That's just, it's so satisfying, especially in the wintertime. And it's different from polenta in that it has the eggs baked into it. So it has a very different texture than polenta does. It doesn't taste that dissimilar, but it does have a different texture.
So what, it's a different tact, but we're talking about cold weather cooking. Cold weather sweets, what do you want? You want something warm, right?
I do. I tend to think of hot chocolate, hot cake, or really sort of things that bring back memories, you know, like walnut cake. My mother used to make a black walnut cake, so did my grandmother and my great-grandmother. Mincemeat pie, I think of that. I think of all those sorts of sort of stronger, well, and cookies, quite frankly, but definitely nice to have a hot dessert. Or even if it's like a hot crumble or a hot, you know, apples with, you know, brown sugar and butter and breadcrumb on top coming out of the oven, or a puff pastry dessert coming out of the oven, can be so wonderful and easy to make.
You know, we had that open house, and Katie made all these cookies. There were these ginger chocolate chips that were just the best damn thing I've had in forever. Coming out of the oven hot.
Oh, yummy.
You know, like with a little espresso in the morning when they're eating. I'm like, oh, my God.
Mm.
The rest of my day is going to be worse than this. No matter how good it is, you know.
Well,
even if all my teams win, the rest of the day is going to be worse than this moment. Because this is warm, and it has that little, it was fun, the yes, there's a little chocolate, but the ginger, that spiciness
mm-hmm.
of that, and the scent of the coffee.
Perfect.
You know, sometimes that gets you. So that, I'm wondering, like, how can I direct the pastry chef to give me those flavors, all of those flavors in a warm dessert, you know?
Right. Yeah, that would
the
be.
The coffee, the ginger, the chocolate. There's got to be a way. Maybe it's in a gâteau or something like
mm-hmm.
that, you know?
Yeah, layers. Yeah,
that's,
for sure.
That's
Yeah, my mother, being Pennsylvania Dutch cook, would do sugar cakes, and she always made the batter before dinner and left it in the refrigerator so that she could make drop cookies right near the end of dinner and bake them to order, and we would have them for dessert. I will not forget that. That was because I've had them cold. Obviously, she would make the rest, and we would eat them cold, but to have them hot out of the oven, I'm with you on that. That was very special. It was very thoughtful of her to think to do that for her family. My goodness, it's not hard enough to make dinner for five people. You know, you get up from the table, and you drop some cookies on a sheet pan and bake them for everybody. It's pretty neat. Yeah. And she used to do she would either put sugar on top, or she would do a burnt butter icing.
How often did you sneak away from the table and get a little bit of the cold batter?
Oh, gosh, never, because I wasn't allowed to get up from the table. But believe me, I would have loved to. Yeah.
Because the other wine thing, it's the reason I ask about what sweets, the other wine thing, like this is the time of the year for the treats, right?
So oh, sure.
But things that warm you. So the first thing I thought, like, oh, port. Mm. You know, you want port wine for, it's very nice for cheese, but honestly, as its own treat or with nuts, like just toast walnuts for a minute, yeah. Have them warm, you know, and a tawny port, you know, even just like simple, like 10-year-old tawny port. Port, so there are a couple of different kinds, right? The three most typical ones that you discover, vintage port are the famous ones, and a lot of the famous houses produce vintage dated ports in certain years that they declare. Great ones have been 94, 85, 77. Those are, you know, back and back, you know, that... Mm-hmm. And the houses that are well known, Taylor Fladgate, Graham's, Quinta de Naval. I mean, that there's lots and lots. But there's also tawny port, and I think that's the most typical one that you'd want to keep around, because vintage port, you open it, it has a huge amount of sediment. It's big, rich. It's wonderful, but you do have to decant it, because otherwise it looks like you've been chewing tobacco for a while in your teeth if you're drinking it. Maybe that's attractive for you, maybe it's not, but that's not my bag exactly. That's what vintage port does. Tawny port is, the color is tawny, and usually it's aged 10, 20, 30 years. Once you get more time, like the 30-year and 40-year versions, they're very expensive. 10 can be very reasonable from the best houses, like a Graham, which tends to be a little sweeter, or a Taylor, which may be a little spicier, you know, or Dow, which is a little bit sort of just like beefier in some ways. Those are three of the famous houses, and their 10-year style is all very good. Those are more modest price-wise and reasonable to have around. And honestly, that's for that ginger chocolate chip, there's your glass of port. And you want it cool, the same way that you'd want a red wine to be cool, not cold.
Got it.
But not 75 degrees in the room.
No.
You know,
used to keep her port in a decanter on the coffee table. That's just the way it used to be. She used to keep sherry in there too. And then, you know, it's just not the right, that's old fashioned, not the right way to do it.
Sherry, depends on the type of sherry, but especially lighter sherries, they suffer at warmer temperatures. Port wine suffers at warmer temperatures. You lose some of the aromatics first and foremost. And part of the job is for it to be refreshing in its way.
Got it. So you want it to be cool.
But also remember, this is not like a 6-ounce glass of wine is a pretty normal serving. Ugh. For port,
it's a lot of port.
It's maybe three, maybe a little more.
That's why the glasses are so cute.
Well,
I love the little glasses.
Though honestly, I like just a regular, just tasting glass.
Okay.
You know, for port is just fine. Though it's nice to have a little cute one, like you mentioned. Mm-hmm. I like the aromatics. That's part of it. Is also. But a lot of times people don't notice that because the alcohol is higher. It's 20 because the wine is fermented and finished sweet, but then it has alcohol added to it to bring the proof up and also to stabilize it.
Okay.
And it stopped the fermentation while there's still sugar that's there. So there is some sweetness that's there.
Do they blend from, like, is there always some really old port in there, like when they do sherry?
No. I mean, usually it's targeted 10-year, 20-year. The vintage date is that 1 year.
I got it. And does each house declare a vintage, or does the whole
They declare their own, but if the whole
Pretty
region has a
region.
Really good year,
yeah, right.
You know, like 1977, everyone declared 1977. And then there's Ruby Port, and Ruby Port is usually the least expensive, very tasty, accessible, easy, and that's your sort of gateway to port. And it's the kind of thing that doesn't necessarily require other things, but it's certainly fine. Honestly, a little dark chocolate and some Ruby Port, there are a lot worse combinations in the whole world than that.
All right. I'm going to have a Christmas dinner, so I didn't even think about getting port for everybody, so that's a good idea. Yeah, I'll do that.
Honestly, it's not such a bad gift either.
that's a good idea.
I know we did a program about gifts. We didn't talk about that, but it's a treat that you don't have all the time, but this time of the year, it's a, you know, little fireside glass port with friends is not so bad.
Mm-hmm.
Madeira is the other thing that I always want something for.
Love Madeira.
And especially if you find vintage data Madeira, it's, you know, that's fabulous. Sometimes you pour that in a glass and it's just the entire room smells like it's the best candy shop in the world.
For sure. Yeah, the aromatics are beautiful.
Madeira is, you see the different, you see rainwater Madeira, which again, like Ruby Port, is the accessible version. But Madeira is a white, not a red wine.
Mm-hmm.
But it's white that's literally cooked to some extent in a controlled way. And I'm not going to give the entire story of it, but there is always that caramelly flavor to it. It has good acidity, though. And there are four different varietals that are different sweetness. You know, that Malmsey or Malvasy has the sweetest, and then Boal, and then Vidalio, and then Sercial is the driest.
Mm.
But Sercial still has some sweetness to it. But they get richer and sweeter as you kind of go. So,
and something else?
And they bottle those as 5, 10, 15 year.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And something else that I never drink is sweet champagne. How do you feel about that after a meal?
Ooh, I mean, the Laurent Perrier bottling Harmony, I think, is the best one that's in the market right now.
Mm-hmm.
That's their wines in general have been really superb. That's, if I was going to put champagne with pastry right now, especially like you're talking about having, you know, like a warm cake out of the oven, like, or for a souffle, or it can take on chocolate in a dessert, but all chocolate, like kill me with chocolate kind of dessert, no.
In order for
and honestly refreshing too, obviously.
Yeah, very, yeah. So do they add sugar to the dosage at the end? Is that where the sugar comes from for sweet champagne?
It's the dosage.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Cool.
That's just different formulas for different
fitness levels. And half bottles are pretty available, do you think, or not?
I don't know if Harmony is in half bottles. The Laurent Perrier.
But it would be nice to be able to get a half bottle just, you know, so you don't have to pour so much, just a little taste. But, you know, you're not drinking port. It's not like as you were, you know, what does the port pour, like an ounce or two?
Pour usually 3 ounces is what you think.
Okay. And then for champagne, you would just drink a regular glass amount?
Yeah.
Sweet champagne, I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, just that's one. If you make excessive decisions to consume that, you will pay an excessive price because of the sugar. That's always the case, though.
With sugar, right.
Anyway, now I'm hungry and I want sweets. that's all we have time for today, Cindy. If you want to listen to this program or any one of our others, please go to the WIPR website, wipr.org. Look for the Former Wolf page, and you can find a big menu of goodies there with past episodes and this one as well. If you want to correspond with us, it's email foremanwolf@wypr.org. Let's see, social media for Cindy Wolf.
You can follow me on Instagram or Facebook as Chef Wolf.
For me on Instagram, it's The Real Tony Foreman. And thanks so much for listening.
Happy Sunday.